is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I don't want to rub it in, but it's going to be 82 degrees here in Florida today. This is fantastic. It's December. This is really going to be so much fun for me because I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Deborah Levine Herman, and we are talking about spiritual writing from inspiration to publication. And she certainly knows all about it. Deborah is so famous. She's a literary agent. And I'm so happy to welcome you to the program, Deborah.
Yeah, and thanks for rubbing it in. I'm in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And I am cold. It is definitely, I have two dogs, and it was definitely a two-dog night.
I know. It's so beautiful in December, 82 degrees. Well, you know, you can come and visit us. We love people to come down here to Florida.
I'm thinking about it.
Okay. Well, whenever you do, you come here to the studio because we have to talk. Your career is so amazing.
Thank you.
And this new book, I think it just comes at the right time because there is a need, I think, for spiritual writing. And your recommendations in the book, your suggestions in the book, they also flow into just general writing because you are so knowledgeable. So tell us about the new book, and then we'll talk a little bit also about what it's like to be an agent, okay?
Yeah, I wrote the first edition of this book 20 years ago, and it was truly ahead of its time. It was before the burgeoning internet. So I had to, and of course I changed over 20 years. The industry changed. I've been in the trenches as an agent, as an author, and now as an indie publisher. So I just had to revise it from the very first word to the end. And in the days when I first started the book, I wrote it because I was teaching writing as a spiritual journey. And finding all of these writers who were they felt very alone and they were misunderstood, and literary agents at the time would say, I don't know what to do with this material. And it needed to happen. People needed to realize that this is a thing, you know, this sense of mission, and nobody can talk people out of wanting to share this message that they have. But they need to know how. So that's how this was born.
I don't understand this whole sort of, there was this negativity for a long time about spiritual writing. But when you look back on history at the great writers, I mean, they were writing for a purpose too. They were writing to encourage people into, you know, believing, into thinking about God, into thinking about important things. So it's not always... It makes no sense.
I know, and that's why I kept at it, because people would tell, I had to teach this kind of writer because of the protocols of the industry, and because I straddled so many words. You know, I went through law school. Midway with law school, it was like, well, you can't quit because you live through it. But I discovered the love of writing, so I combined it. And I was straddling that world where, when I got into my, spiritual work, my colleagues in law school were like, "What, are you crazy?" And I said, "No, this is my path." And these writers who were coming into the spiritual awareness were being told they were too woo-woo because they weren't considered mainstream. So, a couple of things happened. One, certain writers were able to learn the protocols of the industry and to be tested in the marketplace. And two, the demand increased, you know, because people want to read things that are relevant to their experience. So that's what happened.
Well, how do you describe spiritual writing? Because when you look back on it, Herman Melville was writing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get more spiritual than Moby Dick. I mean, he had a message there.
And by the way, his house where he wrote Moby Dick is 20 minutes from my house.
Oh, that's
fantastic.
And
I swear he still occupies the house. He's definitely there.
Well, he was.
And that's my little aside of woo-woo.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's so true. I actually published a book of Melville's poetry the first time it was ever in one volume. People don't know that he was also a poet. It's called Weeds and Wildings, and people can find that when they go to my website. But all of the writers, the romantic writers, there's always this esoteric underpinning, because I believe true writing comes from a connection to the source and to the higher self when it's authentic. And that's why, you know, people were writing about the new age. There was never a new age. It was just age. There were always these esoteric, greater expanded ways of thinking, but they were perceived as just too out of the box and not commercial enough, until certain writers broke through, I guess, and proved the publishers wrong. They didn't want to take risks. And now, actually, publishing is even more risk-averse, which is another reason I reintroduced this book, because spiritual writers especially, or writers that are just not in that, you know, huge, massive platform position, may need to look at alternatives to getting their message out. But there's a lot of opportunity for them to do so. So that was kind of a roundabout answer, I hope, to what you asked, which we may have to rewind because I lost the thread.
No, it's wonderful. If you don't have that within you, that's, I don't know how you are a writer, because you have to have, there's some spiritualness in, well, all of the great writing. They have this inspiration, and it's not, we're not saying that it has to be a Christian inspiration, or it's just an inspiration of something bigger than ourselves and that we want to get across.
I call it the divine inner voice, and that's why part of the book in the beginning is all about what I call the seven lessons of soul odyssey, which I believe are very universal. I apply them, spiritual writing, because it's just a natural to show the spiritual path and the writer's journey as the singular thing. We are all connecting to this central part of ourselves, the divine inner voice, that is the place of our greatest authenticity. That's our message, and that's what we are here to contribute and explore and share.
Now, you've broken your book down. Let's get to the part about transforming inspiration into an angle. What does that mean? Because sometimes people will say, I have this idea, I have this inspiration. Now, what do you mean by turning it into an angle?
It's following the protocols of publishing. The greatest problem I see when I work with authors and when I'm doing developmental editing or, you know, helping someone polish their book is structure. And we can talk about manuscript, or we can talk about book proposal. You can't put a universe in a bottle. You need to choose very strategically what part of that universe is going to be, you know, in that structure, that box, that bottle. And you need to combine your understanding of your message with who's going to hear it and who's going to read it. So that's what I mean by the angle. You need to find what some people call your through line, your hook, your theme. Why does the book need to exist? And then everything else in the book needs to focus and relate back to that central point. And that's how to organize a narrative. You know, it's communication.
Of course, you've seen a lot of book proposals and a lot of books. Do you make instant judgments? How do you know when something is right?
Now I'm in several different positions. I was working with my husband's literary agency, which is a nonfiction agency. I worked for many years and learned some things that were a little, scary about how few books are actually accepted even to be represented by agents. And I learned how to curate those books. So immediately, there are things that will cause a query letter. First step really is the query letter, but the book proposal or manuscript needs to also exist before anybody would send a letter to an agent or an editor. That's number one. A lot of people will sometimes call and say, oh, do you like this idea? Well, don't do that. There's only if we remember. So if we say, oh, yeah, I love it, and then they say, oh, good, I'm going to go write it, you know, it makes us very frustrated. So you have to learn what they're looking for. You have to decode their thinking. Even though a lot of people get into the book business because they love books and they love reading and they love a good story or they love to learn, you know, because there's different protocols for different genres, they have to also decide, can this be marketable? Is this something that more than five people are going to want to read? Because it's a business. And, you know, today's world has the advantage of providing opportunities for content that may only appeal to a niche audience. But if you're going to ask a large company to invest in you, they've got a higher threshold to make it work economically for them. You know, there used to be all these different indie publishers. There's a lot of conglomerates. And, you know, we could spend a whole show talking about that whole thing, but they really have a high threshold of what they can acquire. So immediately, it's not that we make a judgment like I like this or I don't like this. Now, that's in the general marketplace. We look for certain things that can make a book potentially successful. Now, for me, when I'm looking at, you know, books that are by spiritual writers, it is an intuitive thing because I also test my intuition and the energy of the writing, and I feel what that person's goal is. And I'll be much more inclined to look at something or even work with someone if the energy is right, that they are not full of their ego, that their purpose for writing the book is a positive one. So I hope that, you know, it's two different mentalities.
When somebody has an idea for a book, should they immediately go to Amazon and Google what are the best sellers in the area that they're interested in? Do they have to keep this always in mind? Where to find this angle?
If it's a marketable book.
Yeah.
Again, for spiritual writers, I think the first place is, what is your message? What is your authentic passion? Because if you are really, really passionate about something, I believe if you're on a spiritual path, that is going to ultimately lead to what your divine message is and your mission. However, from a business standpoint, you never want to try to follow a trend. It's good to know the trends, but if, for example, there are all these books on angels and you decide, oh, I want to write a book on angels, which happened many years ago, it was too late. Because traditional publishing, the conglomerates, they're at least a year to 18 months behind what you see on the shelf. So you don't want to write to a trend because you think that's going to help you get published. For example, romance is the top most lucrative area of publishing. It would be only wonderful if, when I was starting out as a writer, if I could write romance novels. I couldn't. It wasn't in me. It wasn't my voice. It wasn't my thing. I love to watch Hallmark movies, but I couldn't write a romance novel. Other people, that's what they're drawn to, and they're good at it. So you can't try to mimic what you think is going to be successful. But then again, if you're going to do a book proposal and you want to do a certain kind of book, you need to know what the comparative titles are. You need to know what's out there, and you need to distinguish your book and prove why it should exist. So it's part of the book proposal process and the marketing aspect to determine your reader and if there is a market for your book.
Well, have you ever gotten a book where you like the idea but you don't like the title?
As agents, we'll often massage a submission to make it better and more marketable because people want to be a little bit too fancy with titles, and they maybe want something that's very personal to them, that makes sense to them. But a title really needs to be explanatory. But the thing to remember is if you are given a contract by a publisher, they're going to change your title. And you need to trust them. I mean, you have some say. You don't want something that's really awful, but they know what they're doing, and they know how to position your book for the optimum marketing ability. So, you know, you can't get married to a title. If you want that title and that's it, and then, you know, your life depends on it, then you may not find someone who agrees with you.
In the film business, when you're trying to push a script, you have to have a great log line. Do you look below the title, that log line that comes from the author?
In a query letter, it's a log line and a hook are really the same kind of exercise. So when a person is looking to explain their book, they need to be able to explain it in a very small and fine way. If it's a novel, who's the protagonist? What was the happening? How did they change? And what's the result? That's pretty much a novel log line or hook. You don't want to be cute and hide the ball and say you have to read it to get to the end. No. If you're trying to get someone to represent you or buy your book, you want to tell them in the best way possible of what your plot is. With nonfiction, in the very first paragraph of a query letter, you want to be able to condense the important parts of your book into that very succinct description. So, yeah, it's a crossover, because we don't have that much time for you to engage us and convince us that we want to look further.
For spiritual writers, you know, the ones who have a real strong message they want to get across, they're desperate, really, sometimes to help people to understand, because perhaps they've gone through something traumatic, perhaps they've gone through life-changing events in their life, and they really are eager to help people. When you find somebody like that, do you ever tell somebody, well, you know, I like the idea, but rewrite it again here?
Of course. Because it doesn't serve anybody. I mean, you can get that kind of support from your relatives or your mom or your siblings. You don't want that when you're trying to be successful as a writer. You don't want someone who's just being sadistic and ripping you apart and ruining your ambition and inspiration. But you want constructive feedback with answers of how to improve your work. When a person is desperate, that's a red flag, because it leads me to believe that somewhere in their spiritual path, they believe they are either the only one, that the world depends on what they have to say, that they're the chosen one, and that's a red flag for me for what I call in the seven lessons, the ego lesson. You know, one thing I really want to stress for people who are on a spiritual path is you are not the only one. We're a collective of souls who want to make a better world. It requires humility, and it requires surrender and asking, what is my part and how can I help? Because I've had spiritual writers give me books and say it has to come out by next December because the world's changing and people need this. Well, you know, God's time and our time are very different, and our time and publishing time are very different. You've got to understand that things happen as they're supposed to happen. You can't rush something, and you can't blow it.
I think every writer, whether you're doing spiritual writing, whether you're doing cozy mysteries, whether you're will benefit from your book, because you have the background and the right attitude, and I found a great deal of encouragement in your book for all
absolutely.
Writers.
That's oh, yeah. I really feel terrible when people encounter editors or other writers who take them off the path and discourage them. If you want to do this, you can do this. You know, you have to be open-minded of what the end result is, and you have to be patient. My oldest daughter, on a novel since 2014, she just did NaNoWriMo and finally finished it. But because she's my child, she now knows, now it's time to edit it. Now it's time to get other eyeballs on it. Not like, oh, I finished it, and now it's going to be published and it's
exactly.
perfect.
Well, I think you are an inspiration. And
thank you.
You really are. You are an inspiration for all writers. And I hope that people will get your book, Spiritual Writing from Inspiration to Publication. It's broken down into four parts, and all of the parts address a specific interest. And I want to mention there's the book proposal, the query letter. And as a matter of fact, I need to have you back, and let's just talk one day about query letters and proposals. How about that?
That would be awesome. I really enjoyed your show, and I love teaching writers. It's my jam.
It is. You have a website that's very interesting. Tell people where you want people to come and find you. Of course, the book is available, you know, online and in fine bookstores. I'm sure they should be carrying this and put it actually right by the front door, because a lot of people want to start in January, finally writing their book, and they will benefit from this wonderful book called Spiritual Writing from Inspiration to Publication. And I think, Deborah, you are just fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much, and so are you. I love knowing now about your show.
Well,
I'm definitely going to be listening. I have two important websites. One is souloddysseybooks.com. Really has about me and about the spiritual writing book. I also have micropublishingmedia.com, which is more about the publishing and services and things. You know, if they want some help, that's a little bit different.
Deborah Levine, Herman, you are fantastic, and thank you so much for being a joy today on Joy on Paper.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.